Hey everybody, thanks for tuning in. You are listening to Nocturnal Distractions. I am your host, Kendra. Still getting used to just saying host as opposed to being host and co-host, so you have to forgive me as I get used to that here. And in general, getting used to recording by myself, which feels odd as all get-go. Sorry for the long break here between episodes. Right after I recorded the last one, I lost my voice pretty much like the next day, and then got sick, and then I had a death of a friend, and the research for this next episode was actually a lot more difficult than I thought it was going to be, because if you listen to my last episode, I'm starting a series about the 22 level gradations of evil scale. And so this was supposed to be the very first level or category, which is justifiable homicide. And I kind of figured that, oh, well, it can't be that hard to find, you know, information on cases about justifiable homicide, right? Because people defend themselves all the time against others and wind up, you know, killing them. It's justifiable. It's actually a lot harder to find information on those kind of cases than I thought it was going to be, just because I don't think they're as widely publicized, for one. They don't tend to make it into true crime circuits and other things like that, unless there's other things that have happened, in which case it doesn't technically fit a lot of the times into the justifiable homicide category. So this was a little harder than I thought it was going to be. But before I get into that, this episode, wanted to announce, in case everybody hasn't seen it on the Instagram page, I am doing my very first giveaway. So if you go to the Instagram page, there will be more information on how to enter that and the different fun, exciting prizes that you could win if you enter that. I still don't have any new or updated analytics for any of you, mainly due to that like bug that got into the Anchor app a while back, like the beginning of November, and caused like everyone's total plays to like skyrocket, and that included like messing with the actual states and countries that are listening in on the podcast. And so I don't really have the exact states or countries or number of plays that I am at this point. I would have to go back in and kind of look back through the states to see exactly how many cities in each state are listening in, because generally, if they have two or three cities on there, then that means that there's actually people from that state listening in. But like if it's like one city, then that's that bug, robot, whatever that got in there messing with things. Country-wise, I am pretty sure that I have at least 12 actual countries out of like the, I don't know, 60 that are listed under my analytics that are tuning in. But until I get that figured out, that's where that's at. But I thank everyone out there, all of my listeners that have been listening, that are continuing to listen, I appreciate it. And if you think about it, throw me a shout out in the DMs on Instagram or through an email or just on a comment on one of my Instagram posts. Tell me where you're listening from, so that way I know like what states or what countries I actually have listening to me. But we are just going to jump then right into the next episode, which is going to be the first level of evil, which is technically considered not evil. So it gives you kind of a baseline of what not evil is on the whole scale itself, because it would be justifiable homicide. This case, though, it's still a little, well, let me just get into it, and you guys can decide from there. So on June 5th, 2019, Wendy Howard, age 50, of Tahachupi Town. Oh my gosh, I looked up this town name and the pronunciation like 50 times, I swear to God. I even have it in here. Tuha Chupi. Tuha Chupi. I butchered that and I apologize, California. I swear, I looked it up a ton of times. But Wendy Howard had shot and killed her ex-boyfriend, Kelly Reese Pitts, age 59. Howard was arrested and charged with first-degree murder and enhancement of a gun. I had to actually look that up because I've never heard of that extra kind of a charge being thrown on there. And from what I understand, it means that the charges of like first-degree murder can actually be enhanced or increased due to it being caused by the use of a weapon. So they can use it like enhancement of a, I don't know, various things, but they threw that on there. So Howard was facing 50 years to life in prison, which would mean that she would never see her family again, basically, because she was 50 years old at the time. Her initial bail was actually set at $1 million, and she spent 99 days in jail before the judge reduced the bail amount to $500,000. Now, it was another 3 years before her case finally went to trial, with Howard's pleading not guilty on all charges by self-defense. So that means that this case just went to trial in October of 2022. Very recent case, in other words. Deputy District Attorney Eric Smith sought to portray Howard as vengeful prior to her ex-partner's shooting death, angry with Pitts after her daughter had confided to her that Pitts had been sexually abusing her. Crap. Should have put a disclaimer in here. Sorry about that, guys. Disclaimer. There is talk of child sexual abuse, child abuse, domestic violence, and obviously shooting, death. I apologize. Should have done that at the very beginning. Completely skipped my mind. But there you are now. So, gonna start again. Deputy District Attorney Eric Smith sought to portray Howard as vengeful prior to her ex-partner's shooting death, angry with Pitts after her daughter had confided to her that Pitts had been sexually abusing her. He claimed that she provoked him and planned to kill him when he came over to her house that day, June 5th of 2019, to drop off his grandson to play. Howard's defense attorney, Tony Lidgett, sought to refute those claims by showing his client experienced a range of emotions, not just anger, showing that Pitts was the abusive ex-partner of Howard, who had physically and sexually abused Howard during their relationship until Howard was able to escape him. She then found out that he had sexually abused not only her younger daughter, but also her older daughter, along with a third victim. She decided to confront Pitts in order to protect her family, after which he turned angry and attempted to run her over or hit her with his ATV. She then shot him in self-defense, believing he was trying to kill her. So that's like the very shortened breakdown of this whole situation, which I will be getting more into. After reading various news articles about this case and about Wendy Howard herself, along with her daughters, I can see both sides of this in ways. But after reading the things said in court and how it can be a bit iffy when it comes to what exactly happened the day of the incident, this case can actually be kind of hard to categorize it as in that category one of evil. And since evilness in this series is defined as what the general public would react to as being evil, I think that by the end of this episode, you will agree that this case could fit into either category one or category two on the scale of evil. And at the same time, might be able to see why it's kind of difficult for me to decidedly say that it fits into one or the other, like, perfectly. Just because, like, is it justifiable homicide due to self-defense? Did she legitimately feel like her life was in danger? Or does it kind of fit more into category two, where it could have been premeditated, given that when confronting him, she did have a gun on her, and semi-knowing how he might react to that, or even if she did know that, would it still be justifiable? I mean, those are kind of questions to keep in mind as I'm going through this case. many parents out there would probably agree with her actions and not consider it very evil. But due to it maybe being that vengeful killing and being maybe semi-premeditated, would it fit more into that category too? It's kind of a flip-floppy type of a thing. I'm getting a little bit ahead of myself though, because obviously it's hard to decide without all of the information of this case. And there was quite a bit of information to kind of dig through, because a lot of it was repeated information. Since it is such a newer, it's a newer case, or it's a really current case. And so there wasn't just like one source that had everything from beginning to end. It had a lot of the same news source, but different articles. And so I had to go through about 17 different articles and weed out all the repeated information, trying to find the little bits of new information that wasn't included in previous articles, which is also why it took me a little longer to work through this whole thing and getting it into a cohesive, comprehensive time order of things that went down here. So I'm hoping that this all makes sense, and yeah, I'm hoping this all makes sense by the end of it. So like I said, this is a very current case, and when we get to the end, based on what the jury concludes, you would think that it would be done and over with, but it's not. It's still an ongoing case that has not actually reached a complete conclusion, which also kind of makes finding that info and putting it into the categories a little bit more difficult. So, knowing all that so far, and if you're not already confused enough, let me start from the beginning and work towards the ending in order to give you a clearer picture of the entire picture that leads up to basically the shooting itself. The beginning being when Wendy Howard first met Kelly Pitts. She met Pitts in 2002. Throughout their 3 to 4 year relationship, because the time was kind of unclear there on whether it was a 3 year or a 4 year relationship, Pitts physically and sexually abused her, including beating her with a metal baseball bat while she was pregnant with their daughter, and attempting to both rape and kill her. Both incidents of this were, these were incidents that were reported and filed with the Tehachapi, I'm just going to start calling the Ta Police Department, TBD, because I cannot say that town name to save my life. Nope. Pitts began to molest Howard's older daughter, Miranda, right after her 12th birthday in 2002. Now, I am going to do a quick side note here, because while typically the names of like juveniles who have been abused aren't released into the public records just because they are juveniles, she and her sister, who I will talk about later, have both come out and talked openly about the abuse to the public, because they've held like different rallies and different protests against like their mother being charged and things. And so because of that, And according to the other disclaimers in the news articles that I'm basing my information off of, they said the same thing, like that they normally like don't put these names or their names into this type of stuff. But since they have come out and talked openly about it, that's why their names are being used. I just wanted to put that in there, because obviously I would never use juvenile victims' names or victims' names who don't want to be named unless they had been documented already in other multiple resources. And it wasn't just like one news resource that used their names. Like, it's been all the resources that I've looked into have used their names. So just wanted to throw that in there really quick, so nobody's like, why are you using names of juveniles and whatnot? I'm not showing any disrespect. I'm not trying to. So Miranda's abuse actually continued from 2002 until 2005, so that's about 3 years. Although it is unclear when Howard first found out about the abuse, based on what has been reported about her as a mother and as a person, I highly doubt that she knew about it while it was happening like the whole time. When Howard did find out about the abuse, though, she and Miranda did go to the police department and report it. Miranda Frost, whose last name was previously Pitts, but now goes by Miranda Frost, claimed that Pitts had committed over 100 sex acts and inappropriately touched her, according to previous court documents. However, the district attorney's office in Kern County at the time declined to prosecute Pitts, citing a lack of evidence. So that's kind of the first thing, second thing sort of taken into consideration here. You have, good gravy, you have Howard, who has been in this abusive relationship, who has been beaten with a baseball bat, has been attempted to be raped, he attempted to kill her, and then she finds out he's been molesting her daughter, and when they go to the police about it, the district attorney's office says we're not gonna press charges because there's no evidence. So that's kind of a kick in the pants a lot. Miranda also recalled and backed up the claims that her mother was physically abused by Pitts, and that she was very fearful even after she split up with Pitts in 2005. So I have a feeling, and even though, like I said, it was never actually said specifically, but she left Pitts in 2005, so I think it is probably after she found out about the abuse of her daughter. So she split up with Pitts in 2005, and from that point on, she like hid any of her new romantic partners from Pitts in fear of what he would do. Even with this fear in place, Howard was able to move on and marry her current husband. Eventually, she wound up moving her family back to Tehachapi. Still don't think that's right. Tehachapi. You're going to hear me saying that a lot. Anyway, she wound up moving her family back there, and actually just a short distance away from Pitts. It's unclear whether she made this move before or after she married her current husband, or where she was living before moving back. That was never said in anything that I read about this. So I don't know the answer to that. There are many, though, that have questioned, of course, like why she would choose to move near her and her elder daughter's abuser if she was so afraid of him. Her daughter, other daughter, younger daughter, Bailey Pitts, who now also uses the last name Frost. So from now on, when I use the name Frost, I will be referring to Bailey, whose biological father is Pitts. And she was actually the one that her mother was pregnant with when Pitts beat her mother with a metal baseball bat. But she explained that despite her mother's fear of Pitts, some of her children, including Frost herself, at the time still wanted a relationship with their father because they did not have the whole story about the abuse that Howard suffered. So she is the type of person that never came right out and said, like, your father did this to me. You know, he was abusive, he, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Like, she didn't really want to give them that whole story. Howard also felt the societal pressure that is felt by a lot of like single parents or split parents that raising her children without their biological father was not something that should be done, and that kids needed to have both of their biological mother and father in their lives in order to thrive, which I think is still sometimes a societal pressure that's felt today. Like, oh, you should always have the father in their lives, like, despite the fact that they might be a terrible person, you know, and that's just not true. But I can see how she would feel that way. So since some of her kids did want to establish some sort of relationship with their father, she did what she thought was the right thing by moving closer to him. But unfortunately, doing what she believed to be the right thing to do turned out to have more devastating effects on the family. For example, I did find a news report that said Pitts had altercations with two of Howard's sons, though again, I did not find if any charges were actually filed in those cases. This is just what I read in a news report. The largest shock, however, came in 2019 when Howard discovered that her then 16-year-old daughter, Bailey Frost, was also being sexually abused by Pitts after she attempted to establish a relationship with her father. The abuse had started to occur when Frost was at least 15, but she did not want to tell her mother. So her mother was not aware of that when it first started. Bailey Frost testified that she had never experienced normal interactions with her father, and so she sought out the opportunity to create a relationship with him after moving back into the same neighborhood where he lived, actually on the same street that he lived on. Frost said that everything with Pitts was fine at first, but soon the relationship changed when he started sexually abusing her. She said the abuse began with her father making suggestive comments. That escalated into worsening comments and eventually led him to touching her inappropriately pretty much everywhere. During the trial, she recalled an incident in the desert. She wanted to get her driver's permit, and Pitts had offered to take her to the desert where she could drive alone legally, she said. However, during the car ride, Pitts asked for sexual favors in exchange for buying her a $100 computer. Frost refused, and when she did, Pitts became angry and began to inappropriately touch himself in front of her. Frost eventually confided in her older sister, Miranda, who was the one who had also been abused by Pitts, about the abuse, and they decided calling law enforcement was the right step to take, even if it may take a toll on Frost to recount what happened to her, Miranda said. Her mother, Howard, when finding out about the abuse, wanted to confront Pitts, but Miranda testified that they had talked to her and convinced her not to do that and to go to the police instead. Howard and her daughter, Bailey, or Frost, reported to the police department that Pitts had been sexually abusing their daughter, their teenage daughter, or Bailey Frost, for almost 2 years, according to the police reports filed in court. The police department detectives told Howard and her daughters to wait for their investigation's completion before going to confront Pitts and to act naturally and normally around him, Miranda testified, adding she and her mother put their hopes in law enforcement this time around because there was more evidence of Pitts' abuse than there was when they had reported Miranda's abuse 14 years prior. So you have to remember, too, that this is 14 years after the first abuse allegation was filed against Pitts. But they're still doing what they think is right. We're going to go to the police. We're going to report it, you know, and we're going to put our hopes into law enforcement that they're going to arrest the dude, right? Because there's more evidence, as we will come to find out. Howard testified, though, that Pitts repeatedly called her house after he saw that there were police there when they had come to take the report about the abuse, because Pitts had actually only lived a few doors away from Howard. So, of course, if he's done something wrong and he sees a bunch of police outside of the house, he is going to call his ex over and over and over again just to see what's going on. Philip Jalberts, Howard's husband, testified in regards to Howard's emotions prior to the shooting. He and Howard had texted about increasing security measures around their house after the abuse investigation into Pitts had been launched. Jalbert said his wife wasn't distressed about the investigation into Pitts' behavior towards Frost, but was frustrated by the whole process, mainly due to the lack of investigation or the DA pressing any charges against Pitts when it came to the previous abuse of her older daughter, Miranda. So basically he's just saying like, yeah, she wasn't really distressed about the investigation at the time. She was more just frustrated about the fact that they didn't investigate the abuse of her older daughter. And he also testified Howard would never do anything rash or inappropriate. Jalbert actually said the first thing Howard did after learning about Frost being sexually abused by Pitts was to install security cameras around the house in order to protect her family because she was afraid of how Pitts could react when and if he found out about the investigation the police had started. Daubert commented how the last thing a person who is planning to commit a crime wants is cameras that would capture their actions. He continued by testifying that Howard's emotions are consistent with a parent who has learned about the sexual abuse of their child, and how the couple had never once discussed killing Fitz. So, when Pitts called Howard on June 5th of 2019, which was merely 3 days after Howard and her daughter had filed the abuse allegations report, asking to bring over his grandson to play with Howard's children, Pitts only lived three houses away from Howard's residence on Appaloosa Court, and this was a normal occurrence for him to ride his ATV over and bring his grandson with him. So, acting on the advice of the police, Howard agreed because she had been told to act nonchalant to ensure he did not catch wind of their investigation into the abuse allegations. Howard's relationship with Pitts up until this point had always been polite, but kind of short, according to Pitts' older son, Dalton. However, shortly before he actually arrived at Howard's house, Howard testified. She learned about another victim who had also endured sexual abuse by Pitts. At this point, Howard became even more concerned with letting Pitts near her children and family. So, despite what the police said about acting normal and nonchalant, like, it would be hard enough to do that in the first place, but then to hear about another victim of Pitts right before he's supposed to be showing up at your house, like, you'd be a little concerned. So Frost then testified she and her mother talked about potentially showing Pitts evidence of his molestation against Frost, who actually had a screenshot of him inappropriately touching her. So I'm assuming a picture was taken of him inappropriately touching her by somebody else, and they had sent it to her and she had screenshotted it. Either way, there was photographic evidence of him inappropriately touching her. It was decided that Howard would confront Pitts about the abuse against Frost in order to protect her and her family from more abuse if necessary. Frost remembers being scared about Pitts' reaction when and if he was confronted with the pictures, and that her mother was acting sad, scared, and anxious before Pitts arrived. She watched as her mother put a 9mm gun into the back of her waistband because of her own past abuse at the hands of Pitts and knowing what he was capable of, and that, quote, if anything went bad, she would have to use it, Frost testified. Howard has continually denied hatching plans to confront Pitts about the sexual abuse, but just as Frost had said, she had discussed with her daughter showing Pitts a picture of him inappropriately touching Frost. District Attorney Eric Smith, however, tried to paint a whole different scene. Text messages shown by Smith in court read that Howard experienced anger, guilt, extreme anger, vengeance the night before Pitts was shot and killed. Quote, that's what you wanted to exact on Kelly Pitts? Quote, Smith asked. Not exactly, Howard testified. She added the anger was directed toward the abuse endured by Frost, and her extreme anger was toward the situation itself. Howard said she was not angry as she walked towards Pitts. She testified she was very uneasy that she must try to act normal toward the man who sexually abused her daughters. Quote, I don't think that anything that I was feeling, saying, or doing was anything that any parent wouldn't have thought. End quote, Howard testified. Smith then centered his questioning around the fact that Howard had learned moments before meeting Pitts on June 5th, 2019, about a third victim who had suffered sexual abuse by Pitts. Quote, so as this conversation with the third victim is going on, you're getting even more riled up, even more angry, end quote, Smith asked. Quote, that's your words, end quote. Howard testified in response. She said her emotions ranged from crying to frustration to being upset, which she argued again were all reactions anyone would feel upon learning about another victim who had similar abuse accounts as her daughter. And this other victim was 17 years old, it said in one of the news articles. But obviously her name was not released because she has not come public with any information or has not spoken to the public. So her name is not in any of these news accounts. But there was a 17-year-old that alleged that he had sexually abused her also. Smith didn't back down, though, continuing by asking, "You already had in your mind what was going to happen, did you not, when you went out there June 5th, 2019? End quote, Smith asked. Howard responded by saying that a conversation between her and Pitts unfolded, during which Pitts then said that Frost and himself should go on a trip alone, which is when Howard decided to react by showing Pitts the picture of himself inappropriately touching Frost on the breast. Howard hoped this would allow him to see why she sought to remove Pitts from her life and her family's life. She thought Pitts would know he was caught and would accept her decision-making," she added. So, Howard has testified now that she did not show Pitts this picture or anything else until Pitts had said something about taking her daughter on a trip with himself by themselves. And that's when she's like, okay, I've got to react now and show him this to let him know, like, I know what's going on and that's not going to happen and you basically need to leave my family alone. Instead, though, of instead of Pitts obviously thinking, okay, I'm caught, you know, I'm going to get out of here, he claimed their daughter was a lying, and then just as explicative, I'm going to guess on what word he probably used there, a lying blank, and it did not happen, court documents say. Pitts then began revving up the ATV, and the evidence does show that the motorized vehicle was on at the time, so it's not like he was sitting there with it off, like it was on. Pitts grabbed the phone held by Howard and threw it into the bushes before starting to move towards her on the ATV. Quote, he started getting that look in his eyes that I've dealt with before, she recalled on the stand, like he's going to a dark place in his mind, end quote. Howard claims that he then ran over her foot, but reports on that are kind of inconclusive. Like, sometimes it says that he did, sometimes it says he didn't, but either way, whether or not he did, he came towards her on the ATV. And even if it was very slow moving, like, you could still, I'm imagining, if you ran over somebody, hit somebody, you could still cause damage. I mean, that's what that comes down to. Howard didn't know if Pitts was trying to intimidate her or run her over, but it caused her to pull out the gun in her waistband and shoot Pitts, TPD documents say. The first shot caused him to fall off the ATV, but this did not stop him from advancing towards Howard, so in turn, she shot again. Only immediate danger propelled her to shoot Pitts, she testified, when questioned by her defense attorney, Tony Lidgett. Each time Howard said she fired, Pitts was either coming toward her or she was in fear for her life and sought to ensure the safety of everyone in the house. Even still, Pitts did not die immediately, nor did Howard shoot him again, despite having live rounds left in her gun and extra guns or other guns in the house, defense attorney Lidgett said. He added his client is the one who called law enforcement after her daughter-in-law came over from the neighbor's house and actually helped her find the cell phone. So in other words, she did not empty, like, it's not like she sat there and emptied this entire chamber of the gun, like, into Pitts, you know, like, overkill type of a thing. Nor did she go back inside to retrieve another gun from inside of the household. As well as she actively looked for that cell phone with somebody else to call for help, even though she could have very well claimed that he threw her phone and she couldn't find it. Oh, well, I don't know what happened. Like, he threw my phone. I couldn't call for help. But instead, she only shot when she felt threatened, and she actually called for help afterwards. Once officers arrived, Pitts was not only still screaming at Howard, but it actually took a number of officers to restrain Pitts, who was still alive, obviously, before they were actually able to render aid. So he was not only not dead, he was still yelling at Wendy Howard, and it took more than one officer to... Yes, dear. I am in the middle of recording. No, I don't pause my recordings. That's the point. Like, so this is all going to be on there now. Okay. Sorry about that, everybody. That was my daughter, in case anyone wants to know. Came in and said, "Can you come downstairs?" She's apparently afraid of the boogeyman. After I told her I'm recording. Anyway, where is that? Howard. So like I said, she didn't unload the entire gun chamber into Pitts. And Pitts was still alive, still screaming at her. And it took several officers to even restrain him before being able to render aid to him. So it's not like he was completely laying on the ground, bleeding, like, out or anything like that, you know? So it's one of those things, too, to take into consideration here, because almost from the sounds of it, he could have gotten back up, and she could have potentially shot him more than a couple times as she did. However, the big thing here is... And then, obviously, he did eventually pass away at Kern Medical Center after he was taken there. The biggest controversy within this case is that the exact events of how things transpired in those moments before and during the time that Pitts was shot still kind of remain unclear due to the lack of any other eyewitnesses. I mean, anybody that was kind of around at that time, like, they either weren't out there or they didn't see everything or they weren't sure. Like, it's one of those types of things. So you have Howard's basically recollection of those events and what actually happened. And that's, I mean, position of the ATV, the fact that it was on, all of those different things. But as far as other eyewitnesses to it, we don't really have any. So that's where, like, it's kind of that iffiness a little bit. However, despite prosecutors' attempts to paint Howard as being vengeful, using the text message evidence that she had also sent to her daughter-in-law, Whitney, who was the one that later helped her retrieve her cell phone, and the text messages were about the police investigation into Frost's case, saying from Howard, quote, "I blank want to deal with things my own way and not sitting here on my blank." I'm sure you guys can fill in those blanks. It actually does not actually give the words in here. So it's not like I'm just not saying them, but I will leave that up to your imagination. And Whitney's response to Howard saying that was, quote, "I know, but you possibly ending up in jail, too, isn't going to be good for anybody. What about the kids?" End quote. Whitney texted back. While being questioned by Prosecutor Smith, Whitney denied that Howard wanted to commit illegal actions. When asked by Smith about the messages, she testified that they do not display in-person conversations. In previous conversations, Howard was scared she could go to jail if she confronted Pitts with the molestation evidence. And both of them were afraid because Pitts had a lot of friends in that police department and he would brag about his connections, Whitney testified. So she's kind of saying, like, okay, yeah, you're using these text messages, but those text messages don't display, or they don't show what we talked about actually in person, which is different than what's in text messages, as a lot of us probably know. Like, and a lot of us say stuff that we don't actually mean. Like, how many times has somebody been mad and been like, oh, well, I'm going to kill them, you know, that type of thing. It doesn't mean that you're actually going to. So that's kind of what I think she was kind of like, no, she wasn't actually going to do anything. The trial wound up lasting 10 days, and after being presented both sides of the case, the jury started deliberations late Wednesday, all day Thursday, and came back with a verdict early in the afternoon of Friday, October 21st, 2022. Wendy Howard was found not guilty on the counts of first and second degree murder and involuntary manslaughter. So she wasn't found not guilty on all of those counts. However, the Kern County jury was deadlocked when on the charge of voluntary manslaughter, which has raised some controversy. So here's some more controversies being raised here, because this is due mainly to the fact that jurors, if they found her not guilty of the other charges, the first and second degree murder and involuntary manslaughter charges, they could still find her guilty of either voluntary manslaughter of imperfect self-defense or voluntary manslaughter committed while in the heat of passion. The jury acquitted her of voluntary manslaughter of imperfect self-defense, and I do apologize, I meant to look up what exactly imperfect self-defense meant, but it obviously did not get around to doing that. So I'm not exactly sure what that means, but either way, they acquitted her of that one. But seven jurors voted her guilty of voluntary manslaughter in the heat of passion, and five voted for an acquittal, leaving them hopelessly deadlocked. So what does this mean exactly? And according to Assistant District Attorney Joseph Kinzel, quote, in general, when there is a hung jury on a charge or lesser included offense, the case is automatically set for future dates for a retrial on the charges that remain unresolved, as well as for discussions regarding potential resolution, end quote. So, basically that means, so that as of the current moment, right now, as I'm talking to you right now at 9:03 p.m., January 22nd, whether or not Wendy Howard will be taken to trial and retried for voluntary manslaughter in the heat of passion is still undecided. So even though the jury has found her not guilty on first degree, second degree murder, and of involuntary... Oh, I lost my train of thought. Good baby. And involuntary manslaughter, and has acquitted her on voluntary manslaughter of imperfect self-defense, the fact that they were deadlocked on the voluntary manslaughter in the heat of passion means that they could retry her on that offense. Which kind of, that blows my mind in general. A December 2nd hearing, so I mean, literally a month and 20 days ago, so a December 2nd hearing date was held to determine whether or not the retrial would take place. But the defense attorney, Tony Legit, said during the hearing that Howard has actually been acquitted of every charge, and prosecutors cannot relitigate the same facts. He then entered a once-in-jeopardy plea, and Friday's hearing concluded. A motion's date for February 21st has been set for Howard's attorney, Legit, argue how a once-in-jeopardy plea should stick in this case. So a once-in-jeopardy plea stems from the U.S. Constitution and California Constitution, Raimondo, who is a local attorney, said. It's to ensure that defendants cannot be retried on the same charges when they've been acquitted of them, attorneys explained. It is also sometimes referred to, I think you'll hear it as like double jeopardy type of a thing. The other big thing with this case is the fact that they split up that voluntary manslaughter into two different things. So instead of just taking it all as like voluntary manslaughter, like the judge decided to leave it, like give it to the jury as here's two different types of voluntary manslaughter, and you have to vote on both of them whether or not she's guilty, which is not, as far as I'm aware, and as far as everything that I've read about this case, like, that does not happen. Like, it's just not a thing. You don't hear about it. It doesn't happen that way. It's very odd and strange. And, like I said, but that's in my opinion. I am not a lawyer, not an attorney. I don't know a lot about the legal system, but that's the first time that I've actually heard of something being split up into those like that and actually voted on separately in that type of way. And really, that's all the information that I have on this case. And I know I didn't have like a lot of background on Wendy Howard herself, you know, anything like that, just because it's such a current case that most of that hasn't been released yet. And just digging through the news articles I did, there was a lot of information to dig through anyway. Here's the other thing. So when I started off this episode and questioning which category of evil this would fit into, obviously, because you just listened to it, that's what I did. And the more I got into the articles and my notes together and getting my notes together, my mind kind of like changed to lean one way more than the other. And really, I think that Wendy Howard did react out of self-defense in order to protect not only herself, but her family from a man who had abused not only herself, but also her two daughters and other victims not related to the family. And so I would, in my opinion, consider this to be a justifiable homicide and therefore not evil. So fits into category one, despite what the DA's office is trying to prove. And I still don't understand, because even after reading a bazillion articles, I don't know why they are so hell-bent on painting this poor woman as a vengeful person who planned and lured Pitts to her house with the pretense of killing him. Like, I don't believe it at all. And obviously I have my notes written out ahead of time, so I already knew this at the very beginning. But when I started off, I was kind of like back and forth between the two. And so I wanted to kind of start off as back and forth between the two, so that way you guys could kind of throughout the whole thing, maybe try to come to like your own conclusions. I didn't want to sway you one way or the other right out of the gate. But it's one of those things where it's like, she didn't ask Pitts to come over to her house that day, you know, and he had been continually calling her after he saw the police vehicles at her house. And I think that's probably one of the reasons he called her that day to, you know, 3 days afterwards to bring his grandson over, because he wanted to figure out what was going on. And she didn't confront him with this evidence of him molesting their daughter until he said something about taking her on a trip with him alone. And that's when her mom was like, okay, I've got to act because I need to protect my daughter. And at that point he became angry, and she knows what that anger looks like and what he's capable of. Obviously she's been beaten by a baseball bat by him before. And so she took the action she felt necessary to defend herself and her family against him. And she didn't overkill. She didn't, you know. So that's, like I said, that's my opinion there. But I guess, like, you know, what's your guys' opinion? Do you think it was self-defense? Do you think it was premeditated? I urge you, please, to read up on this case yourself if you would like to. I always leave all these sources that I use in my show notes, and there's quite a few links to website articles this time. So, you know, by all means, if you would like to read through them, let me know what your feelings are. Let me know if you have a different opinion on this, or if you have some more information on this that I might not have been able to get a hold of or might not have seen that would sway you in a different direction, I guess. Anyway, that is the case of Wendy Howard. And how I think that what she did was justifiable homicide. And I don't believe that the district attorney's office has any ground to continue to put her family through this trauma that they're putting them through, especially when it's the exact same district attorney's office that wouldn't prosecute Pitts when they first went to that office with her older daughter's abuse allegations and said, oh, there's not enough evidence. And yet they're trying to pin all of this on Howard against the, yeah, it's just, it boggles my mind, this whole thing. But that kind of concludes my category one of the evil gradations of evil scale, which is basically then not evil. So next episode, I will actually be starting then on the section two of the gradations of evil scale, which includes impulsive murders in persons without psychopathic features. And it begins with the level or category two, which is jealous lovers, egocentric, immature people that commit crimes of passion. So now you can see why, like, at first it was like, well, could this one fit into category two? But I don't think it does. I think it's category one. In my opinion, it's category one all the way. And if any of you that are just kind of tuning in are like, what is she talking about, this evil scale? I mean, if you want to go back and listen to season two, the premiere episode, I kind of explain it more. But I am doing these all so that way they can be listened to as separate episodes along with a continual type of a thing. Reminder again that I am holding that first giveaway. And there's more info on that on my Instagram page. And there's a link to all the links down in my show notes that will let you access that entry form for it. I know that I'm giving away a really cool magnetic flashlight that you can stick on your fridge. And I've got glow-in-the-dark stickers now and a few other things that are surprises that I'll throw in there for the winner. Any reviews or subscribers, if you want to subscribe, are generally greatly appreciated. If you want to leave reviews, Spotify is a great one to leave a review on. Apple Podcasts, if you leave me a written review, I would love you to death because that's super, super helpful. And it gives me some feedback. Like, I really would like to hear feedback. What do you guys think? How are you liking this whole solo thing so far and this whole series that I'm attempting to work on? Any questions or suggestions, I can be reached at nocturnaldistractions@gmail.com. You can DM me on Instagram. I try to check that daily, so there's that. You can also find me on Facebook. I have a Facebook group, or Twitter. I don't check Twitter as much as the other ones, but they're there too. And like I said, I usually have a link to all my links, and that way you can access all the listening platforms. You can access the donation pages that I have that kind of help me keep going with this podcast, because there are certain subscriptions that, you know, I have to pay for to get to news articles and music and just equipment, different things like that. Books, I do research using books a lot of the time, and that stuff costs money, unfortunately. And that's any money that I get donated to the podcast, it goes right back into the podcast, which in turn brings greater content to you guys to listen to. So I think that is all. I will hope you will join me next time for the next level of evil. Let me know what you guys think. And love you all. Night night. Bye.